You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Republican lawmaker about his bipartisan work to fight Alzheimer's and dementia.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, Molina Healthcare announced it won't be selling health plans next year on Wisconsin's marketplaces set up through Obamacare. The insurer has the largest market share for health plans sold directly to people and families in southeastern Wisconsin.
Robert Menster joins us now, as he does every Friday, to talk about that and the other big news in Wisconsin this week. He's a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
Well, Molina Healthcare made this announcement on Wednesday. How big a deal is this for marketplace healthcare coverage in Wisconsin?
So it's a worrying sign. It's notable for sure, and it will affect some people. But it is also important to say this doesn't leave any counties in Wisconsin without a health insurer for the marketplace. In Milwaukee County, where most of the people are and where Molina's business was focused, there remain three different health insurance plans. So there is competition in those exchanges. So, I mean, it's a thing. Some people who go to sign up for their individual health care plans in later this year will have to change insurers, and there may be some changes that come with that. And for sure, it's the type of trend that those who are skeptical of or opposed to the Affordable Care Act, and the system that it established, can point to. But on the other hand, it's unlikely that, for instance, this is going to mean that those 55,000 people don't have insurance. There's still insurance available to them.
And from what we've heard from the company Molina, is the gist that it's just too hard to make money doing this?
Yeah, Molina is hard up. The company has pulled out of state exchanges in a couple different states. They, in late June, announced that a bunch of layoffs coming to that company. So their business model has been based around it. They have been a provider for Medicaid and sort of low income services, and it is a legitimate problem. It is something that that policymakers ought to look at why it is that they're not able to sort of stay in business on this business model, because that is a place where there is a risk that people who are low income, maybe they make a little bit too much to qualify for Medicaid, but they are still poor. If they can't get insurance, that's a risk area.
And you mentioned the political fallout here. Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir from Brookfield tweeted after the announcement, "Molina's exit from Wisconsin's Obamacare markets is another sign of the law's utter failure. Time to hand the reins to the states." Are we seeing a lot of that kind of reaction, especially from Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, maybe Republicans should look into some legislation about that, don't you think? I mean, there's a little bit of a time warp effect there. Like, that's the type of reaction that that would have happened last year or the year before, or before there was a Republican president and a Republican push to make changes to the law, repeal the law. But yeah, this is a data point that that those who say that it is not a sustainable system can point to, and it's a substantive problem as far as it goes.
Talking to Rob Menster from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the big stories around the state this week. On Tuesday, Rob, a federal appeals court ruled to keep federal protection for gray wolves in the Western Great Lakes region. This has been an ongoing saga. The ruling said the government had made errors, crucial errors, when it removed wolves from that protection 5 years back. So talk us through the Cliff's Notes version of the back and forth on the wolf story here.
Sure. So for folks in northern Wisconsin, let me start here. There's no question. What we know is happening is that the wolf population is increasing. That is widely shared scientific consensus. There are more wolves today than there were 20, 50 years ago. There's a lot of debate over exactly how many that is and to what extent the wolf population in a place like northern Wisconsin is a risk to livestock, to people who live there. Every so often, a wolf will kill kill somebody's dog, and that's very sad and that's a real problem. So, and then there are people who like hunting and that see it as a challenge and want to hunt the wolf. So, so at a time, you said, whenever a few years ago, the Wisconsin instituted a wolf hunt, and it's been on for a couple years and off for a couple years. I think am I right? The last one was in 2014. Is it that long ago?
It's been a while. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Yeah, I didn't have it in front
of
me.
It's been a couple years, I think.
It's been a few years, and So right now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources estimated that as of this summer, there are about 925 or 950 wolves in the state, which is up a little bit from the previous years. But, I mean, this is sort of the whole debate. It's very hard to track wolves. The estimates are not that precise. They do things like fly over the land during the winter when there's no leaves on the trees to try to do a count. People track footprints in the snow, paw prints, and so they try to estimate as best they can. But this is a big part of what is contested, is how many wolves there are out there.
And what makes for a sustainable population. So for now, as long as this court ruling is the law of the land, there will be no wolf hunt in Wisconsin. Is that right?
That is right. The next big push among those who see it as a hazard is to try to have Congress delist the gray wolf, pass a law saying that wolves are not endangered and it's okay to hunt them. It seems there's something that maybe seems a little weird to have a judge declaring that wolves are or are not endangered, and it's definitely also weird to think that Congress would do that. But this is a step that has actually a fair amount of support, including in Wisconsin's delegation. Republican Senator Ron Johnson is for it, and some of the Republican congressmen have spoken out for it. And notably, and maybe surprisingly, Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin also has come out in favor of this this delisting. So I don't know that that necessarily stands a chance of becoming law, but there certainly is support for it in Wisconsin.
Quick look at the Foxconn story. Of course, the big story there is in southeastern Wisconsin, but there's talk of a Foxconn smaller facility in Dane County, and the mayor of Madison looking at an old site for a new plant. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, right. So it's the Foxconn news that they're looking in Dane County is, we should take a little caution about that, but it's something that they're considering and looking on. And Madison Mayor Paul Soglin pointed out that Madison has this big Oscar Mayer facility that was closed last year, and then this might be an option for locating an electronics manufacturer, as opposed to, in Soglin's words, as opposed to eating up a couple hundred acres of farmland.
And then finally, Rob, a state fair kicked off yesterday, 125th Wisconsin State Fair. What's the big story there? What does the fair have to offer?
Oh, it has beer-battered, bacon-wrapped cheddar sausage on a stick. It has deep-fried grilled cheese sandwich bites, deep-fried Nutella. I mean, it has it all, right? I believe it's 125th year in State Fair Park
State
in
Fair
West
Park.
Allis.
Okay.
I think the fair itself, I have in my notes, 166 years old.
Wow,
this year.
Wow, okay.
It doesn't look a day over 150.
And do you have a favorite thing to see or do or eat at a state or county fair, Rob?
So I know that this is going to be controversial.
Uh-oh.
I know there are some people out there who say the cream puff is overrated, but I disagree. I stand for the cream puff. Those cream puffs rule.
Wait a minute. Pro cream puff is the controversial position, Rob?
I am not going to be intimidated by the anti-cream puff people. I'm going to speak my truth, Rob.
One cream puff is a serving for you, or do you go back for more?
I can do with one, thank you.
One? Occasionally I can fit a second if I haven't eaten too much of the deep-fried food first. Rob, I'll point you toward the Central Time Facebook page. We talked about fair food. Get a recipe for a spicy peanut butter and jelly, wait for it, cheeseburgers. So that's what's for dinner this weekend.
That's
Rob,
disgusting. You don't know what you eat that.
Thanks a lot for joining us, as
All
always,
right.
Rob.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us every Friday for a look at the state's biggest news.
Bipartisanship may be a little harder to come by these days, but it hasn't gone away entirely. Our next guest is a Republican representative from Neenah who worked successfully with a Democratic colleague in the Assembly.
Together, they led a task force on Alzheimer's and dementia, which led to the passage of several key pieces of legislation.
Representative Mike Rohrkast joins us now. He's with us to talk about the work of the Alzheimer's and Dementia Task Force, bipartisanship, and what's next. Representative Rohrkast, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you first connect with Democratic Representative Hesselbein and discover that the two of you had the potential to work across the aisle on a common cause?
Well, Speaker Robin Voss wanted to initiate a bipartisan task force on dealing with the issue of Alzheimer's and dementia here in the state of Wisconsin, as it's been it's a significant issue now, and it continues to grow in terms of its impact to families and individuals throughout the state. Through that process, then, I had met, obviously, Representative Hesselbein before that, but I found out that both of us really had, people in our family who had suffered from this disease. Each of us had, my mom and I believe her mom as well. And so we had a personal connection to this, and we also saw, again, the needs of so many families out there that are trying to deal with this, and it can be a struggle at times.
And as you said, the both of you had this common background of having a parent who struggled with it. And it never happens in isolation. It affects the family and, to a bigger extent, the community as well. Would you be willing to share some of your own personal experience with your family and Alzheimer's and dementia?
Absolutely. My mom lived in Ohio when I was working here in Wisconsin before I got into the legislature, and we kept trying to get her to move to Wisconsin because that might have been easier, but trying to deal with it over distance was exceptionally hard because I couldn't physically see sometimes what she was going through. Eventually, we had to have her placed into a nursing home, and again, that distance creates problems. And it does put stress on the family. I mean, I was trying to do work, but then I would have to address issues that were coming up before my mom was in the nursing home. She had a penchant for calling 911. She kept thinking she was having heart attacks, and the EMTs would be visiting her a half dozen times a day, and eventually, obviously, that can't continue to happen when there wasn't any physical issue, but it was really as a result of her deteriorating ability to think through, cognitively understand what was happening to her. So that was really what prompted us to have to put her into the nursing home. And again, it was stressful trying to deal with that over a distance. And at that time, I'll be honest, I did not know a whole lot about the disease. I had seen my mom progress from just having a bad memory to then some of these more difficult behaviors that you could tell it just wasn't her anymore. Also, I guess it was a struggle when we went to visit and I had younger kids back then. She didn't really know how to, and sometimes control herself in what she might say around the younger kids. And again, it's hard to see that, and your kids don't understand too. So any family that is going through this issue, I can relate personally, both as a son, as a parent, and as just as an individual that cares about somebody. I mean, it's a very hard thing to go through, and whoever the person is and whatever the situation might be.
Right. It can be a tough time. My family went through it, too. And having gone through it, as did Representative Hesselbein, what did that tell you about the problems that needed to be addressed as the issue of Alzheimer's and dementia grows in Wisconsin?
Well, I think one of the main issues that we came out as from our task force and both from my personal experience is there needs to be greater understanding and education of what Alzheimer's is, what some of the progressions are, so that you can better understand what's happening and then hopefully maybe help have a more positive experience with the person and be able to help them as the disease progresses within them. The other is to really provide that, and this is related to the first, but focus on the caregiver, both in education but also in respite care. And that was one of the main bills that we got passed, where we almost doubled the, we did double the amount of money that was available for the state's respite care program. People who are caring for those with dementia, if they don't take care of themselves, they're also susceptible to falling ill, whether through heart disease or stress or even mental illness, because of the pressures that it takes. So that was one of the big areas that we, both Representative Hesselbein and I, really wanted to focus on.
We're talking with Representative Mike Rohrkast right now, a Republican from Neenah, and he worked with Democratic Representative Diane Hesselbein from Middleton on a special task force to address the growing issues associated with Alzheimer's and dementia in Wisconsin. And as you were getting at there, several significant pieces of legislation did come out of that task force, including that respite care and also a special crisis unit, which was intended to pilot a program. Could you tell us about that aspect of it, what that pilot program would do?
Sure. And this is to help families that may have an individual that has dementia and is portraying or exhibiting much more difficult behaviors, could even be violent behaviors or destructive behaviors. Those are much more challenging. Thankfully, there's not as many of those, but when they do occur, they're very traumatic. And so that's really what that program is designed to do, is to put more resources in place and to help individuals or families that might be experiencing that. They're similar in concept to the mental health service crisis units, but we want to use it specifically for those suffering from dementia and those that are the maybe the most difficult situations to deal with.
So the task force had some results, some legislation passed, but what else is top on your to-do list in this area?
Well, there were several things that we didn't get passed in from the task force, but fortunately, there's a few things that are at least in the proposed parts of the state budget at this point. The governor did add $100,000 of research to the UW system. There was a bill last year that would have done something similar. It didn't make it through, so that's still in the budget proposal at this point. The Joint Finance Committee, of which I'm on, we did add the funding for dementia care specialists as well, and actually expanded that program. And these positions work in the local ADRCs in the counties, and again, their role is to provide support to families that need care for a loved one. So it gets back to that, let's help the individuals, the families that are dealing with that, so that they can provide better care for the person that's suffering from the disease. The other area that we did put into the budget, at least as long as it ends up, we haven't got the budget done yet, but once we do, was we increased the Medicaid reimbursement rates for assisted living, for nursing homes and personal care providers. And that's important to attract and retain more of care workers that are in these organizations, many of which are helping in elderly people, many of which that could be suffering from dementia. So we've been able to put some additional things in the budget, and we'll continue to work on programs that we can identify that help the family and help those caregivers, whether they're formal caregivers in a nursing home or the informal caregivers in a family.
Now, going back to the funding allocated for research, specifically, what do you think is most urgent in the research department?
Actually, I think obviously a cure would be the ideal. There is a lot of research, though, that is going on at that. What I would say, though, is that better diagnoses, and the UW system is working on that, but that would be an area that I think could really help. Because if they can diagnose Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia earlier, there are certain either lifestyle changes that the individual can make. There's also certain medications that they don't stop the disease. they make the quality of life either longer or better for the individual suffering. So earlier diagnoses, I think, would be really critically important right now. And even the $100,000 grant, when you could then match, get hopefully federal matching dollars to that, it could actually help provide some breakthroughs.
Now, looking again at the process here, you and Representative Hesselbein had success working together, even in an era when there can be a lot of partisan rancor between Democrats and Republicans. Having had that experience, what do you think goes into the secret sauce, the components that
well,
make this work?
I mean, obviously we can have different ideologies in certain areas, but this is such a nonpartisan issue. I mean, everybody, or most everybody that I have talked to, has either currently dealing with the situation or has already dealt with somebody. And again, this is setting aside any partisan ideology and looking at, okay, how can we help not only the individuals that are suffering from the disease, but also the families, because again, the burden on them is also very, very challenging. And so let's figure out a way to come together on this. I will tell you, too, when I campaigned for the first time, a lot of what voters told me, they said, we want to see you and others work together better from the other side of the aisle. And I took that seriously, and I think Representative Hesselbein has a similar view. Voters don't want us to, they understand we have certain differences, but they do want us to work together when we can find common ground.
Representative Vorkas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Representative Mike Vorkas is a Republican from Neenah. He worked with Democratic Representative Diane Hesselbein from Middleton on legislation to address the growing issues associated with the Alzheimer's and dementia issues in Wisconsin.
President Trump's 17-day vacation to his private New Jersey golf club began today. The White House is calling it a, quote, working vacation as he and the rest of his staff move out of the West Wing, which is undergoing renovations.
Most presidents do take vacations, but President Trump's is getting additional attention given his past statements. He criticized former President Obama for his time away from the White House and often spoke about how much golf Obama played.
Obama, it was reported today, played 250 rounds of golf, and he's going to be in Hawaii, I think. Did they say for 3 weeks? How can a president for 3 weeks? I don't have time for that. I love golf. I think it's one of the greats, but I don't have time. 250 rounds, that's more than a guy who plays on the PGA Tour plays. He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods.
But there's a long tradition of presidents taking vacations and getting criticism for it, too. Kenneth C. Davis joins us now. He's a historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned, and other books of the series. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be back with you. And I guess we should say right off the top of the show here that no good vacation goes unpunished, especially when it comes to presidential vacations. Nancy Reagan, of course, once said in defense of her husband's frequent trips to California, presidents don't get vacations, they just get a change of scenery. And I think that's probably a very accurate and appropriate way to start this conversation.
Yeah, and it seems like this has been a regular tradition for some time. Well, you can tell us how far it goes back. President takes time off to the extent that a president is ever off the clock. And then the other party criticizes the president for that. How far back does this debate go?
Well, John Adams got criticized.
He was really early there, too.
Yes, and we're talking about the second president for leaving Philadelphia for way too long. Part of the problem there was that they were in the midst of a yellow fever epidemic, and so that was part of his, I suppose, very good reason for leaving in the summertime. And so certainly part of it goes back to the notion that that the Congress used to leave, even though the recess is a fairly recent creation from the 1970s, but Congress used to leave Washington regularly in the summertime because in the days before air conditioning, because if you know Washington, it's not a pleasant place to be in July and August. So it was always expected, anticipated that presidents and Congress would take the dog days of summer elsewhere. And certainly there are many, many presidents who have long traditions of taking lengthy stays away from Washington, D.C. But of course, especially in the modern age, you're never far away from the job. And I guess that man carrying what they call the football, or perhaps woman, that officer carrying the so-called football, the nuclear codes, is a constant reminder that you're never really away from the job when you're president of the United States.
When we look at President Trump's time off so far, and then this vacation, this working vacation, as he's calling it, starting now, how does he compare to previous, maybe recent presidents?
Well, the record holder, it seems, in recent years, I think, is still George W. Bush. At the same point, at one point in his presidency, he was well over 500 days of vacation in 8 years. I don't know if that works out. The Washington Post is pretty good about keeping track of all these presidential vacations. But of course, again, anytime the president is away from the Oval Office, he still is surrounded by his cadre of advisors, military and otherwise. He's still taking phone calls, whether they come at 3 a.m. or in the middle of the afternoon. There's a tremendous amount of work that is done. So it's not as if the president is, you know, pulling the headphones off and putting his feet up on a beach chair or a golf cart for those 17 days. So, this to me seems in some respects to be much ado about nothing. And of course, many terrible things happen in August. I am reminded of, for instance, that August 6, 1945 is a date that is, we will be marking in a couple of days, the day that Harry Truman made the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. So August might be the dog days, but a lot of serious things happen in August.
Talking to Ken Davis, historian, author of Don't Know Much About History and a lot of other books in that series, looking at presidential vacations. Ken, there's been criticism of the president, not so much necessarily over him taking the vacation now, but over doing it after what he had said about President Obama, his predecessor, and his vacations. Is there something there?
Well, I think so. I mean, it would be one thing if he were just taking the vacation and hadn't laid down this very, very serious marker, which he did during the campaign on more than one occasion. And President Obama was absolutely excoriated many times, not just by candidate Trump, but by the conservative media and other people who thought that President Obama going off to Martha's Vineyard for 2 weeks in August with his family, while there were terrible things happening in Iraq, was a great offense against the nation. Again, every president before and since will probably have to deal with this. It's a soft target, after all, to hit. But President Obama was golfing, and that was specifically what candidate Trump singled out. And of course, as many people have been documenting these days, this is a president who has spent a fair amount of time on the golf course, his own and others, since taking office in January.
Yeah, it seems like there's a whole social media subgenre, if you don't like whichever president is, put a picture of a really serious current headline next to a picture of said president playing golf. You see this a lot.
It's a pretty easy target. Again, you think about Barack Obama on Martha's Vineyard, and there were very bad headlines coming out of Iraq. In fact, he then had to have a press conference while he was there, probably something he wouldn't have done if he had been in Washington. But it becomes then a point of contention. And so just to make it clear that the president is paying attention, they trot him out and make sure that the cameras are rolling. This is all part of this kabuki drama of the presidency that has been heightened, especially in the age of social media and 24-hour cable news, where people need to have something to talk about all the time. And very often they're talking about some things that don't really matter when there are very important things that we should be talking about.
You know, President, I haven't done the job myself. It looks like it'd be a lot of work and a lot of stress. Are people out there making the case in general that, yes, presidents need whatever chill time they can find?
I think that that's a really fair thing to say about any president, regardless of party or politics. Of course, there were some presidents who really took things kind of easy. I think Harding was known to be not such a terribly hard worker in his day, Warren G. Harding. But, I have trouble sleeping at night if I, haven't paid my bills on time, or if I think I haven't paid my bills on time, the check. So I can't really imagine what it is like to be the president, to have all of this on your plate all of the time. And they must have, really, some must have nerves of steel to get through it. Americans are not very good, by the way, at vacationing to begin with. And so this whole kind of Puritan notion that if you're having fun, you're not working hard is part of what's in play here as well. So there's a lot of cultural and American curiosities about this. I'm sure the Europeans think we're all crazy for even discussing this question. They have no problem with going away for the month of August.
We're talking to American historian Ken Davis about presidential vacations as President Donald Trump's kicks off a vacation today at his private New Jersey golf club.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the 17 days the president is taking off on vacation starting today? Did you agree with his criticisms of President Obama for taking time away from the White House? And do you think presidents should be limited in the amount of vacation time that they take? You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with American historian Ken Davis, looking at presidential vacations. President Trump's begins today at his golf club in New Jersey. It comes after he said he wouldn't take time away from the White House and criticized then-President Obama for his vacations.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you think of the president's decision to go on a 17-day vacation today. Do you think vacation should be limited? Why or maybe why not? And should the cost come out of taxpayers' pockets? Do you think President Trump or other presidents have taken too much time away from the White House? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. Claire is with us in Madison. Claire, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica. I don't necessarily have as much a problem with the golfing part of it, which is rather ironic. But what I do have a big problem with is, and imagine if President Obama had done this, or any other president. He brings this huge staff along. He's closing the whole West Wing down, so, I don't know, a couple hundred employees? I have no idea how many. Then he rents them rooms, meals, golf carts for security. That's another issue, security. But he's profiting from taking them there. And the other issue, I'd like to know what this remodel is costing. He must have planned that practically from day one. Are we going to have gold-plated sinks in the West Wing now?
Clara, thanks for the call. Let's take those one at a time, Ken. One difference, people are saying, hey, this is his private for-profit business, and the government is on the hook to pay for all the staff to pay rent, in effect, to his business.
Well, that's been an issue with this president from day one, that the word emoluments has been tossed around more in the last 6 months than it has in the last 60 years, probably because of this question of the president using his personal facilities and getting reimbursed for it. A lot of people have ethical and perhaps even legal questions that they feel that this raises. The question of the president going away and taking staff is always part of the deal, because presidents have large entourages of people. I'm reminded, for instance, of Gerald Ford took a lot of flack when he went skiing in Aspen. I think it was Aspen. It might have been Vail, but one of those two kind of she ski resorts. And he was criticized because it was a recession, and he took all these Secret Service men with him, and they all had to know how to ski, and they had to rent skis. So, you know, these become almost absurd in a sense. And by the way, I just want to fact check myself here. According to the Washington Post, it was George Bush who was the most vacationed president. He had 879 days, which seems like an awful lot of vacation time during his two terms in office.
And she had mentioned the West Wing renovation. I had read, I think this is true, this is actually an HVAC. Speaking of that air conditioning in Washington, D.C., this is to an overdue repair to the heating and cooling system there.
That is correct. This is apparently, according to The Hill, work on the 27-year-old heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system at the White House. So that's, you know, again, if you've been in Washington in August, you want to make sure the air conditioning works, and so that this seems not to have been, it's not any kind of renovation of the White House quarters at the request of President Trump, but apparently deferred maintenance.
Clara, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Andy in Sebula, Iowa. Andy, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Andy?
Well, I just turned on the radio, and I listen to this program all the time. Thank you for that,
thanks,
by the way, for being on, you know. I heard they were discussing about the president taking time off and, like, regulating or not. I don't think you should regulate how many days he could take off, because he's got to deal with the world's problem. I mean, I know you can't take, like, 6 months off, because that is a long time. You still got to take care of everything. But you brought up George Bush taking, like, 800 days off. Why am I not shocked? I have nothing bad to say. Just one thing I got to say is that George Bush must have been living that dream, right? Hanging out with his friends all the time.
And Andy, thanks for the call. Andy says, yeah, we don't need to regulate or limit presidential vacations as long as it stays within reason. Ken, no argument there?
No argument from me. I think perhaps the caller missed. I think it's bear saying again that Mrs. Reagan said presidents don't get vacations, they get a change of scenery. But George Bush, for instance, George W. Bush, when he went off to Texas, my recollection seeing him, he wasn't playing so much golf, although his father was, I think, a pretty big golfer. But we'd see him, you know, clearing brush.
Clearing that brush. Right? There was always the picture, yep.
Clearing brush or occasionally mountain biking. And that, you know, that seems to be, you know, perhaps a more acceptable form of a vacation for a president as opposed to playing a round of golf. Now, golf happens to be a favorite of presidents going back a long time. There's an extraordinary photograph, for instance, of William Howard Taft, the most portly of presidents, playing golf. It's a rather comic photo, and you can pull it up from the Library of Congress, I think. Dwight Eisenhower also was a constant golfer, really a serious golfer. So there's nothing new about presidents and golf. Many presidents used to be typical presidential activity for a lot of the earlier presidents was fishing. George Washington would go fishing, in fact. He liked to go fishing, but Coolidge was a big fly fisherman, as was Harding. And so, you know, these questions really become moot, I think, when we do remember that at any moment the president may get a phone call that will require a decision that can affect the entire world. And so they are going to be taking people with them. Apparently about 200, we were talking about the entourage that comes, 200 people accompany the president. We're talking about aides and Secret Service agents and military advisors, and they have to have obviously carefully maintained equipment to so everything's secure. So this is a moving of the White House in many respects, and not just the president flying off with a few friends to sip cool drinks and ride around in the golf cart.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk to Ken Davis, a historian, author of Don't Know Much About History, and scads of other books on American history, looking at presidential vacations, past and present. You mentioned that security issue, Ken, and I was doing some background here. I know James Garfield, President Garfield, the second president in the United States to be assassinated. What I hadn't known it was at the beginning of a vacation.
That's right. He was walking out of, he was leaving Washington and was going to Union Station. Again, this is, the times were very, very different. The president could probably at that time have walked down many streets and be unnoticed in a time before, the president's face was so recognizable. But indeed, he was shot on the way to the train to go to, I believe it was New Jersey. And in fact, he then was taken to New Jersey, where he lingered for months in terrible pain. So that was, one of the downsides to heading off for that vacation. Obviously, security around the president becomes more and more of an issue when they're away from the confines of Washington, D.C., which is a much more controllable situation for the most part. We also now understand that the Secret Service and the Trump people are having some problems about where the Secret Service is staying when they're guarding the New York office. And apparently they've been moved to a trailer outside on the streets of Manhattan instead of within the Trump Tower itself. So this president has certainly posed a unique set of problems for the typical security detail.
Ken, looking back at presidential vacations, do any others, apart from ones we've talked about, stand out to you as particularly memorable or unusual for presidential vacations?
Well, one that stands out in my mind is less a vacation than the fact that FDR used to go to Warm Springs in Georgia to relief of his polio and his paralysis, and it was there in 1945, of course, April 1945. Not a summer vacation, but a stay in Warm Springs that he dies. So that was a fairly extraordinary moment in presidential trips away from home. It was Harding who also dies on a trip, although it wasn't a vacation. It was much more of a typical campaign trip. He was out west and died in San Francisco of presumably a heart attack.
Apart from those tragic incidents, though, is there generally a sense as we wrap up, Ken, that, hey, it's good for the president to get out of D.C. for their mental health, if not their physical health?
Well, in ordinary circumstances, I would say we all acknowledge it's good to decompress, get away, maybe talk to different people, see different things, recharge our batteries. All of those things go with the idea of a vacation. I just come back to the original point, which is that I don't really think a president ever escapes the office goes with him and its duties and its responsibilities. And they must be an incredible burden that, as I mentioned earlier, can't even imagine how that can keep you from sleeping at night.
Ken, thanks as always for joining us.
And enjoy your vacation if you get one. And we won't keep track of how many days you go golfing.
Just back, and I lost count. I'm not a golfer myself. Thanks to Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in that series. Joins us to talk about the tradition of presidential vacations.